Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Lost in Science for another week. My name is Claire and I am here for the next 30 minutes with you as we delve back into our archives and bring you some of our favourite science stories from years past. And not just any science stories from years past, it is Christmas time and we love ourselves a Lost in Science Christmas story, and you know what? Once a year, it just isn't enough time to tell all the Christmas science that there is. So this year, we're taking an extra week to bring you some of our favourite Lost in Science Christmas stories. So this week, we have two stories from the archives, and the first Christmas story we have is actually from Kat, who wondered, like I'm sure many of you have wondered and I have wondered, how Santa does it. How on earth does he get around to every single child and all those houses and deliver all the presents? Kat actually takes us on the journey to calculate how many houses Santa has to visit in one single night. She's taking a real scientific approach to understanding the magical ways of Santa Claus. And the other story that we are bringing out from the archive from a few years ago now is from Stu. And this is a good one, especially if you haven't put your Christmas tree up yet and you're wondering what you should do this year. Should you buy a new plastic one? Should you buy a live tree? Or maybe you're thinking about trying to find a native tree that you can keep in a pot year in, year out, and then decorate as a tree. Well, Stu's going to break the botanical Christmas tree science down for us all. So, more Christmas than you can poke a stick at this week in preparation for our end of year Christmas special. On with the show.
Listening to Lost in Science, and I'm going to get a little bit lost and stuck into some mathematics as I work out how many houses does Santa have to visit each year.
Oh, wow.
Chris, you already pointed out, like, well, not everyone makes it to the nice list, but, you know, the question is, does he still visit the naughty list? And so naughty versus nice, that's pretty hard to enumerate, but I'm going to try my best at working out how many children he goes to visit.
Right.
But I guess that's the thing, right? Who counts when it comes to a kid in terms of Santa delivering presents? So it's certainly, you know, there doesn't really seem to be an upper age limit in the Santa child gift pipeline, because, you know, people will filter out. But We don't really know how that's determined, and is belief in Santa a prerequisite for receiving the gift?
I think there's like is there a 2 or 3 year grace period when maybe belief has waned but love of presents remains?
Yeah.
And Santa's a very kind and benevolent fellow.
Yeah, so like, you know, is it 10-ish? Is it 18? Like, probably not as high as 18. But according to UNICEF, there are an estimated 2.4 billion children in the world under the age of 18. Now, Santa, you are probably familiar with this fact, is somewhat derived from St. Nicholas in the Catholic canon. So, you know, Christmas is based on Christian faith, but Santa isn't necessarily limiting his generosity to those of a certain religion, because there are certainly thousands of children in Australia alone who, you know, don't necessarily adhere to Christian traditions, but, you know, nonetheless, they expect a present from Santa.
Oh, he must get annoyed as, like, the tradition spreads.
Yeah. And, you know. More children.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's actually some interesting data that comes from the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, because, of course, they collect demographic and cultural data detailing nearly every country in the world.
For Santa. It's for Santa,
yeah,
though.
Just for Santa. Yeah.
They have a list of who's naughty and who's nice, but they define it in their own terms.
I think they've been on Santa's case for a long time. Yeah, yeah. They've been playing the long game with Santa, the CIA.
Yeah. Are we making a movie? This sounds like I would watch this film.
Coming to a cinema near you.
They know he has access to a lot of hydrological data. I mean.
We need you for the river statistics, Santa. Yeah. Get over here.
So in terms of the statistics that we have, we can work out the national population by age, and we can work out the composition of a country's religious identity. So, like, you know, how many people in a certain country are going to have certain beliefs. And although it's not actually easy because they kind of say Christianity, right? But Christianity is blended with other belief systems in some places. And, like, the question is, you know, if it's a blend of Christianity and traditional knowledge, which it is in some cases, like, does that include room for Santa? Who knows? And then some Christian denominations like Jehovah Witnesses, for example, they don't celebrate Christmas at all. And then Eastern Orthodox Christians, they celebrate Christmas in January. So it's kind of a little bit all over the place. But if you kind of take a lot of this data and work out, you know, who kind of loosely falls into the I'm expecting Santa to come, it kind of is around 536.8 million kids who expect presents, plus an additional 13 to 14 million who might fall in a maybe category. Like, you know, the CIA doesn't exactly say these people believe in Santa and these people don't. So you kind of have to skirt around by beliefs. Thankfully, though, he doesn't actually have to visit, you know, around 537 million separate houses because some children live in the same household. So, you know, in that case, it's two birds, one stone, or sometimes more birds, one stone.
If all the birds in a house are getting one stone for Christmas, that would be a sad Christmas for all those little birds.
As long as it's not stone as in coal.
Oh, that's right.
So the UN actually compiles information on the number of people per household in different countries. And in some cases, even actually specifies the number of people younger than 15 in one household. So that actually kind of helps you work out how many children are living in different households. And this gives us 396 million households that Santa has to visit with, you know, another 8.7 million in the maybes.
It's getting down. Yeah. It's getting down the number, but it's still a lot.
It's going down.
Yeah.
And in terms of where they all live, like, Santa might not have to make so many stops in some countries. So there are certain countries where it's pretty blank in terms of, like, if Santa had to put pins on where he was going to visit, because a lot of children wouldn't believe in this kind of thing. And they don't celebrate Christmas. But the country with the combo of the largest population and highest density of Christians is the US. That would be where the largest number of children that Santa might be expected to visit is, with nearly 42 million children in total. So that's a lot of kids that you'd have to visit in America.
How many time zones are there in America?
I don't know off the top of my head, but several.
Does that work in Santa's favor, I suppose?
It kind of does, yes. If we get time, I was going to talk about the fact that, you know, we talk about the Santa having to deliver on Christmas Eve, but because of different time zones, that actually gives him over 30 hours to deliver presents around the world.
He's going
up and down, north and south.
So he would have to go, like, up, down, up, down, up, down.
Oh, that's not efficient. He needs to harness the jet streams. Maybe there's a... He could be spinning up and then spinning down around the planet. Okay.
Maybe he is trying to work out, like, you know, where can I just put them in the rivers and they'll just flow down to all the children?
Come on, Chilton, let's go down to the river and get your presents. Floating down the stream, yeah, yeah.
Not in the Northern Hemisphere if the rivers are frozen.
Okay, that makes it hard. The country that's actually easiest for Santa is, in terms of where he would actually visit as well, is Monaco. Kind of makes sense. It's pretty small. And there are only about 3,100 kids that he'd need to visit, and they're all relatively close together. the density of children relative to the country's total area is lowest in Greenland. But they're all really, really close together in Monaco. And can you imagine in Australia, like, we're all congregated around the edges, so we make it a little bit difficult. Of course, there'd be some children he visits in the middle, but it's pretty hard. But, you know, when is he going to be doing all of this? As I pointed out, Santa delivers presents on the night of Christmas Eve. Or, you know, if you're really generous, you can give him the early hours of Christmas morning too. But also, he does it when it's dark. So it's not just that he's delivering it on the 24th of December, he's also delivering it in the dark. And up north, that's not a problem. Because of the Earth's tilt, there are actually different amounts of daytime and nighttime that you experience, depending on where you are in the world. And at the North Pole, it's constantly dark in wintertime. So that's pretty easy for him to come and go. But in the Southern Hemisphere, we've got a lot of daytime, especially closer to the Southern Pole. So that makes his job a little bit harder. You know, if you think about us, we will have just passed the summer solstice, the longest daytime and the shortest night of the year. So we've got a lot of daytime and not much darkness for him to be able to do his little trek.
So he really earns that cookie and the beer.
He really does.
From us, doesn't he? Like, we do. We make him travel along. We've got different time zones, but the nights are the shortest as they're going to get, and he's got to travel all the way around. He can't just pop them in the one little spot like in Monaco. I'd never thought of that before. Poor guy.
Yeah, and he's coming down from 700 kilometres up.
Yeah, exactly. He's got to go through the Earth's atmosphere, which is, you know, famously about 10 kilometres high here. So he's got to, you know, re-equilibrate his ears and all those kinds of things.
Yeah. Not to mention all the chimneys in Australia, most of them are boarded up. I mean, we don't really use chimneys anymore, so it's hard for him to get into the chimney as well.
Yeah, he has to fiddle with, like, the lockpicks and stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. Everyone's houses now. He does that. It kind of makes sense for him to start as far east as possible and then work his way heading west to remain under the cover of darkness as Earth rotates in relation to the sun. There's a long journey for Santa as he visits, like, all of these million kids. And as you say, Lyndon, you know, really does earn the cookies. He'd have to travel, like, if you don't even think about going down into different people's houses, delivering a present, eating, drinking, and then going up again. Like, it's microseconds at each house to do it all. He's a wonder.
I was going to say, is it possible, like, as an explanation, that there is more than one Santa? Like, there's actually...
Mrs. Claus drops out.
Yeah. I'm starting to doubt this whole Santa thing is what I'm saying.
I mean, we can.
Maybe now.
Maybe next year we should think about Santa as part of the multiverse.
Right.
Some sort of multiverse of Santa.
So not only is he ducking in and out below the atmosphere and whatever, like ducking in and out of this universe.
Yeah, exactly.
It did occur to me that you're saying there is more dark hours in the Northern Hemisphere than in the Southern Hemisphere, but there's also a more higher Santa receiving population in the Northern Hemisphere, so that does work in his favor as well.
It does.
I just want to know who is in the lab, who's in the logistics office. How many PhD elves are there running these numbers, organizing these stats, organizing the route, maximizing efficiency? Like, geez, that'd be a tough job, but satisfying, wouldn't it? It'd be like Houston, you know, the control room.
Oh, well, it's constantly dark. There's nothing else to do.
That's true. Better run some numbers and try to maximize the route. Yeah, that would be a fun hobby, but also very rewarding.
So go, Santa, and hopefully he visits you.
Christmas in Australia is weird. Let's just get that out of the way before we go any further. We have completely imported a holiday, co-opted from traditional festivals of winter from the Northern Hemisphere in Europe. It's been plonked down in the Southern Hemisphere on the same date, but literally the opposite time of year. And we have adapted zero of those traditions for our geographic reality. The commercial properties of Australia and homes as well are decked with boughs of holly and artificial snow and men in red fur-lined suits. And, of course, Christmas trees.
Hmm.
The Christmas tree in Europe was a symbol of life persisting through the winter, while many trees in Europe lose their leaves to conserve energy. Conifers, which is what most Christmas trees are evergreen, so they don't lose their leaves in winter. So bringing branches or whole trees indoors in the winter would be something to focus on and often came with a pleasant aroma, a piney smell, if you chose the right species, obviously.
So just on that, there's not a particular species that is the canonical Christmas tree. It's just any old conifer, is that right?
Honestly, it depends where you are, because obviously there's different species in different parts of Europe particularly, which is where all these traditions seem to come from. So different species of conifers, and conifers are, you know, cone-producing plants. That's what the name means. They're botanically called gymnosperms. They're non-flowering plants, mostly evergreens and often trees. But you've got your pines, fir trees and spruce, and basically whatever's around is what people use as Christmas trees, depending on the part of Europe you care to look. And in Germany, it was fir trees that were their Tannenbaums. They're loyal Tannenbaums? I don't know. In the 19th century in Germany, though, a growing middle class increased demand for fir trees because people had bigger houses and they want bigger Christmas trees. And fir tree forests were depleted every year as decorations for midwinter, or more or less, you know, when Christmas falls. So they were chopping down all their fir forests in Germany. And this led to the invention of artificial Christmas trees. And these artificial Christmas trees, these German artificial Christmas trees of the 19th century, were made of goose feathers, which were dyed green and attached to wooden dowels arranged around a trunk in the shape of a fir tree.
See, and I would imagine there'd be more fir trees in Germany than there were geese.
Well, you know, it would have reduced the demand on the tree population, but it was probably something of a concern to the goose population, you would think. But, you know, of course, we are talking naturally occurring forests, and geese are bred as well as you know, livestock. So you're sort of replenishing the supply of geese, but maybe no one was replenishing the supply of forests. So the artificial tree spread to the UK. Queen Victoria's husband Albert was of German heritage, and they imported quite a few traditions from the German people. And they sort of became part of British tradition. And the decorating the tree was a particularly German thing which they adopted. People did it all over the place, but that was where it came from in Britain. But artificial trees, the idea of artificial trees soon took off on their own. And many different versions appeared as you move into the 20th century, including bristle trees. There was a company who made toilet brushes and they went, we could make Christmas trees using the same technology, using animal hair and twisted wire.
Yeah.
Very creative. I mean, good little earner for the brush company, I suppose. And then, you know, as technology advanced, we had aluminium trees in the late 50s, which were very fashionable and popular until a Charlie Brown TV Christmas special, which aired in the mid-1960s, basically put an end to the popularity of aluminium trees in the US. So Charlie Brown in the show actually chooses a live Christmas tree as the centerpiece of this play that he's putting on. And, you know, everyone shuns, sort of dismisses the aluminium tree as being fake and awful and tacky. And everyone who watched the show went, oh, we can't have one of those aluminium Christmas trees. So they didn't. No one bought them. They all went for live trees again for a little while. And nobody ever wanted an aluminium tree ever again.
Wow.
So, yeah, Charlie Brown, powerful, powerful force for for the anti-aluminium Christmas tree movement.
Good grief.
Good grief, indeed. But, of course, by far the most commonly found, most commonly bought artificial Christmas tree is the fake plastic tree, usually made of PVC or polyvinyl chloride, sometimes polyethylene, different plastics, doesn't really matter, with varying degrees of realism from the hyper-real to the absolutely unrealistic tree. They're basically green and Christmas tree shaped, I suppose, is the defining feature. Now, fake trees are still very popular, and thousands and thousands are sold each year. Sometimes people claim that they are more environmentally friendly than real trees because you're not cutting anything down. And looking back on the tradition of the German tree, this may be sort of a hangover of that concept. Now, they may have started as a way to preserve trees, but the production of plastic trees is not exactly an environmental success story, especially if we look at carbon emissions. So a live growing tree is a carbon sink. That is, it removes carbon from the atmosphere and turns it into tree, particularly the woody parts of the tree, which are mostly carbon. So now a plastic tree, on the other hand, can produce around 40 kilograms of atmospheric carbon. You know, people say, well, you know, but the real tree will break down and release that carbon back to the atmosphere. So if a real tree ends up in landfill, in the worst case scenario, decays into methane, which is the most potent greenhouse gas you can have decaying organic matter turning into, it actually won't even produce half the equivalent greenhouse emissions. So it'll produce a maximum of about 16 kilograms of CO2 equivalent if it is basically anaerobically decomposing in landfill, which is not great. And there are better ways that you can get rid of it. Even if you burn it, it doesn't produce as much as the methane.
So how much did the plastic tree?
40 kilograms in manufacture, okay, and transport. So maximum of 16 kilograms in the worst case scenario for a live tree. Now, of course, artificial trees are likely to end up in landfill as well because PVC as a plastic is non-recyclable. So, as you said, the plastic is also storing some carbon, but it's not really enough to offset the amount of carbon released in production.
Yeah, it doesn't weigh 44 kilograms.
No, it does not. It's been estimated that an artificial tree would need to be reused for 10 to 20 years to balance the emissions it produces compared to getting a real tree every year. And most people just don't hang on to Christmas trees for that long. The problem is plastic trees, artificial trees are very cheap, and real trees are more expensive, and that will always draw people to get the cheap tree. And because they are so cheap, it means people will throw them away and replace them as well. So there's sort of a marketing problem there, as you know, on that side of it. Now on the downside for real trees, most of the Christmas trees you see in Australia are Pinus radiata. Pinus radiata is an exotic species in Australia. It comes from overseas. It's not a native Australian plant. It can be an environmental weed in many areas. So if the trees grow big enough to produce pine cones, they will produce seeds, and those plants can spread into the environment be invasive in natural bushland areas. So there's a bit of a problem from there. And also the pine plantations themselves tend to exclude other plants and animals. They're not really a habitat tree for native species because they're not native trees. So nothing here is really adapted. You often get a sort of a very oversimplified ecosystem where you get rabbits and foxes and blackberries and pine trees. And that's a very common sort of guild that develops. Now, growing trees can also use a lot of water, which is not a great thing if you're in Australia, but Pinus radiata is generally pretty drought tolerant, which is why it's an environmental weed. But they often are given extra irrigation to green them up prior to sale. So you make them look all nice and lush and green just before you sell them. So they do actually use some. And there's also additional emissions from transport. Obviously, most of these plantations are close to, you know, urban centres where the market for Christmas trees is, though, so it's not a huge amount of transport. It's certainly not on the scale of bringing them from China. But also pruning and shaping operations. There might be fertiliser involved and things like that. But they grow them for about 7 or so years before they get cut down and resold. And when they do cut them down, they replant a new tree because that's what they do for a living. But I think if you weigh everything up, I think real trees slightly edge out artificial trees in the environment states. But of course, you know, the traditions themselves might be what we should focus on changing, rather than going, oh, what's better, a fake plastic conifer or a real conifer? Maybe we could look at, you know, the opportunities to use local plants that are Australian.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, because there is a bit of a move to that. Is that possible? Because I've seen a lot of people, for instance, like the woolly bush from WA, but does that survive as an indoor Christmas tree? Can you move it around like that, or is it just going to be in your garden? How's that going to work?
Most trees will not live for very long indoors. So, you know, the 12 days of Christmas might be your absolute limit to keeping them indoors, and then you've got to get them back out, and then you've got to get them to adjust to being back outside again as well. The issue also is growing them quick enough to get, you know, a turnover so you can have a product to sell every year. So the woolly bush is a great looking plant, but it doesn't actually grow that fast. So if you did have one, you'd want to keep it for a few years as it got bigger, possibly. But yeah, there's plenty of ways, you know, there's plenty of other plants that we could potentially harness for that, and think about some summer friendly ideas to decorate the house and celebrate in a more seasonally and geographically appropriate way. There's plenty of Australian plants that we could think of that are looking great at this time of year, and we don't need to go, oh, we've got to bring in this plant because it's so cold and dingy outside. I am very glad. I think we can all thank Charlie Brown putting an end to aluminium trees. That sounds like not a very pleasant thing to have in your house. It sounds very pointy and sharp. But even if his live tree choice in the cartoon made the ending of it a little bit sappy.
Oh, dear.
And that's all we have time for on this episode of Lost in Science. Stay tuned over the coming weeks as we do our wrap-up of 2025 and Christmas shows as well. Lost in Science is recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nations and the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at lostinsight@gmail.com. Or just listen again next week when Lyndon, Claire, Chris and Stu get lost in science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.